Good afternoon, everybody. Please be seated. I'm sorry. This is the time set for our last case today. It's case number 68345, Bank of New York Mellon versus Star Golden Enterprises. We have Mr. Stern for the appellants, Ms. Gilbert for the respondent. And also, since we've got other people at the desk, could you identify who's with you? And Jack, Ms. Gilbert, will you identify your folks too?
Thank you, Justice Terry. With me is Rebecca Bodum.
Welcome.
And with me is Diane Klein-Ebron and Jesse Hanna.
And welcome to you too. We're ready for you, Mr. Stern. Did you want to reserve some time for rebuttal?
Yes. When defendant, we say 5 minutes, but
I'll keep right, track for you and let you know how we're doing.
Thank you, Justice Terry, and other members of the court. We are here on an appeal of a quite high order in favor of Star Golden in a Nevada HOA case, one of many cases. And in this case, we're asking for reversal on several grounds. First, that the district court committed an error in making its summary judgment determination exclusively and solely on the recitals in the trustee's deed upon sale. Secondly, that the district court did not permit discovery and did not, as a result of that, allow the parties to develop, much less consider, many factual issues that pertain to the reasonableness of the sale, as well as the legal propriety of the sale. In addition, we asked for reversal on the ground that there was a pre-sale tender of the super priority component of the lien that would have cured the and satisfied the super priority component, an issue that the district court did not reach. And finally, the facial constitutional challenge that the court, I'm sure, has been under. That has been raised in this and many other cases.
Mr. Chair, I know we have a lot of issues here, interesting issues we're grappling with now. I'm specifically interested, though, in the tender offer on the super priority loan, what happened, what the evidence was. I hear from Ms. Gilbert about what their position is, because, I mean, that concerns me if that was offered and declined.
Thank you, Justice Gibbons. It is an important issue for us. We presented both documentation from the bank's counsel, the Miles Bauer firm, and also a Rule 56F affidavit indicating that we would further develop the tender. In both the original motion and the motion for reconsideration, that issue was essentially not addressed. The district court entered judgment in favor of Star Golden, basically on the basis of the trustee deed recitals, and essentially held that the recitals in the trustee's deed are not only conclusive but preclusive of other issues as well, and so the court did not consider at all the tender. And if you look at both the order on the original motion as well as the order on our motion for reconsideration, there is no mention even of the tender, whether it was sufficient, whether really anything.
Was Shadowwood cited before or after Judge Smith entered his order?
It was decided after.
Okay.
So, in fairness to the district court, the guidance from Shadowwood did come afterward. Having said that, many of the issues that we presented in our appeal in this case, which do post-date Shadowwood, we anticipated, even if the nomenclature, if the terminology wasn't one-to-one, we did anticipate the issues, but we call commercial reasonableness, which I believe in this court addressed in Shadowwood as the overall fairness of the sale, taking into account all of the factors, and that was one of the issues that we did raise with the district court. And it's, again, an issue in which we really were not only heard, we were not really even allowed to get into discovery to try and develop facts to make a compelling showing. I remind the court that the procedural posture of the case was very early. We hadn't even had the discovery scheduling order come out yet. It was before the discovery period had even started, let alone finished. And so I think the reason that this report pulled the plug on us as quickly as it did is because it viewed the trustee deeds recital, as I said a minute ago, not only conclusive on the issues of notice and the occurrence of the default, which we believe was an error of law, but also preclusive of all other issues, as if the deed recitals obviate the need to look at things like them, like the sufficiency of the price combined with other factors, or even the overall fairness of the sale. There was, I think, also in the in the response brief, a considerable amount of time spent on the alleged bona fide purchaser status of the buyer here, and that was another issue in which there was no discovery. So we have, as in other cases, the constitutional problem here, and I'd like to address that, but before we even get there, we have many issues of fact that were never developed. And
well, you made your 56F request, the judge did not grant it, so your position is you needed time to develop these issues, the tinkling, the tender, and all that.
Correct, and on the 56F affidavit, that's another issue in which the order from the district court does not even say one way or the other that it's granting it, denying it. Obviously, it denied it because it granted judgment against us, but it didn't explain why. And so as the court here addresses that issue, there was no finding on the part of the court, on the part of the district court, that the 56F affidavit was insufficient or lacked specificity or anything else. It was not addressed at all. Again, the decision here was based, as far as I can tell, 99, if not 100%, on the trustee deeds recitals.
What specific issues did you put forth that you needed discovery for to oppose the summary judgment?
As we set forth in our 56F affidavit, there were two principal issues. One is the notice, and I will direct you to the record on that, Justice Douglas, the sufficiency of the notice and the effect of the tender. In other words, we wanted to develop why it was that Nevada Association Service, the trustee on behalf of the HOA in this case, did not respond to the letter. It has been our experience with NAS in many instances, in many cases, that they had a policy and a practice for responding, or not responding, I should say, to attempts by the senior deed of trust holder to pay. And we wanted to develop discovery or develop further facts on why that was. And most particularly established that by making the offer to pay the entirety of the 9 months, which this court subsequently held was the correct amount in the Ivan Holmes decision, that satisfies the super priority lien, and so the sale that went forward would have been a sub-priority sale. And that would have been an important part of our discovery, Justice Douglas, and that includes evidence from NES itself as to what its policies and practices were for responding to these letters, how they prepared their ledgers, how they calculated the super priority amount, all of those issues. And the second issue that we identified in our 56F affidavit was our view that in the nomenclature of the Shadowwood decision, again, before the Shadowwood decision, we called it commercial reasonableness. It's really the same thing, the same concept, that the sale was not fair on all of its terms. And that includes, once again, the tender. Now, the tender not as a legal act that discharges the super priority lien, but one factor of many to consider in the overall fairness of the sale. Those factors we wanted to develop, as well as others, for example, whether the purchaser here is a bona fide purchaser, as a claim, the district court didn't find it, but as a claim. So those are the issues that we would have developed in discovery, and we just, the district court pulled the plug on that before the case even got started.
Mr. Stern, I know you're in the interest of time, you're going to get into constitutional arguments. Just for you and Ms. Gilbert and all, no, we're closely following that Bourne Valley case. We realize that we know the current status of it. We don't know if anybody's going to file for certiorari to the U.S. Supreme Court on that. So we're kind of waiting to see what happens with that case, or if there's anything else in the pipeline. So I don't know if you're involved with that or Ms. Gilbert's involved.
I think Ms. Gilbert is probably in a better position to speak to that. My guess is that they are going to file a cert petition because they hired a Supreme Court specialist.
Okay. Well, that was one of my questions, so we got that.
So, good sign.
No, good. So, unless they had another reason to hire this, right? I think that is forthcoming, Justice Gibbons. I would like to address the constitutional issue. As you're closely following it, there was an order as recently as yesterday. I won't spend too much time on the status, but I do want to address the challenge as we set it forth in this case. We set it forth in a motion to reconsider. The district court granted reconsideration and then reaffirmed its decision. And the subsequent and the order on the reconsideration, and the way what I think the district court was basically saying is that the motion had been considered and it's part of the record, it's part of the rationale on which it based its decision, but the order does not address the constitutional analysis one way or the other. It once again really comes back to the conclusive and in this case with preclusive effect recitals of the trustee deed upon set. So we asked the court, in addition to the tender and the failure to basically the deprivation of an opportunity for the bank here to develop the fairness, the record on fairness, we also asked that the court follow the Ninth Circuit's guidance on this issue and hold that the statute is facially unconstitutional. We believe that the Warren Valley decision at this point has been, as you know, having followed its status, it's been through several rounds of post-judgment briefing, and it's at this point, I believe, good law in the Ninth Circuit. And it, we believe persuasively, in a manner that this court should find persuasive and follow, explains why the statute does not guarantee notice to the holder of the first deed of trust. Both the provision that addresses the notice of default as well as the notice of sale has the permissive language in which the notice is only required to be sent if the senior deed of trust holder has requested it. I think what was said in the response and what is typically said in response in all of these cases is that NRS 107-190 should be incorporated. And we believe that Warren Valley provides persuasive guidance for why that's the why that would not be the correct interpretation of the statute, and that is it would render the two provisions, and for our record here, that's 116.311.632 and 311.635, utterly superfluous. They would serve no purpose. It would be meaningless to have a provision that mandates, or that allows, I should say, the senior deed of trust holder to request notice if notice was mandatory anyway. We also point out that in the NRS 107-090 itself is kind of a hybrid statute. It's an opt-in statute as well as a mandatory notice statute. And if we read the incorporating, or so-called alleged incorporating statute 116-311-168, when it says that 109-090 is incorporated, the very next sentence says, and it uses the definitive article, the request for notice shall have the following information, the address of the deed of trust holder and other contact information. And so it's really, we understand the constitutional avoidance doctrine and we expect that's going to be a significant part of the pushback here on the part of the investors. But the constitutional avoidance doctrine is not a license for the appellate courts essentially to radically redefine statutes. And we believe that in order to interpret 116-311-168 as incorporating the entirety of 090, including a mandatory provision for notice, would conflict with other canons of statutory interpretation and leave the court in the position of essentially twisting the statute into a pretzel for the purpose of saving its constitutionality. And while we try to interpret statutes consistent with constitutionality, it shouldn't extend to an absurd outcome where you're essentially taking out entire parts of the statute that are rendered completely superfluous by that interpretation. So with that, I will reserve the rest of my time, if that's okay, unless there's questions.
You've got about 2 minutes left, so I'm going to give you an additional 2 minutes, and Ms. Gilbert, I'm going to give you 17 minutes for your presentation. So you have a few extra minutes to rebuttal. Ms. Gilbert, you have 17 minutes.
May it please the court. Before explaining to this court why affirmance is appropriate, I'd like to take a few minutes with this court's indulgence to talk about Warren Valley, because I think it's one of the most important issues you have before you today. Bourne Valley will be the subject of a cert petition to the United States Supreme Court, in part because Bourne Valley Court did not respect this court or the SFR decision, calling this court's interpretation of NRS 116 meaningless. It is this court and not the Ninth Circuit that gets to ultimately say what NRS 116 means. They are bound to follow your guidance, not vice versa. This court should reiterate its construction of that it gave the statute in SFR, making it clear to the banks and to the Ninth Circuit that NRS 116 mandates notice to junior lien holders of record. When it does so, it is likely the Supreme Court will remand with instructions to revisit Bourne Valley consistent with this court's instruction. Bourne Valley acted as if this court never issued the SFR decision. It acted as if the Ninth Circuit and not this court has the final say about the meaning of Nevada law, and it doesn't. As both Judges Gordon and Judge Dorsey from the U.S. District Court noted right after the Bourne Valley decision came out, that the Ninth Circuit ignored this court's construction of the statutes, including the recognition in your dissent, Justice Gibbons, that the notice was required to be given to all junior lien holders of record. Judge Gordon lamented that, quote, the Bourne Valley majority opinion does not address the fact that the Supreme Court of Nevada has already construed this statute to require notice to mortgage lenders. Even the dissenting justices in SFR agreed that this was the proper interpretation of the Nevada statutory scheme, end quote. This was in the case Deutsche Bank versus SFR, issued on August 18th, 2016, and it was for a motion. It was granting an order for stay.
This is from Judge Gordon, U.S. District Court decision.
District Court decision, which is in general in compliance with what the dissent did. So it's not even me telling you that you did it in SFR. Other judges saw you did it in SFR. And the Ninth Circuit didn't even address it. It ignored it. It ignored Justice Pickering saying the incorporation includes 107.09.03b and 4. It ignored that the majority said that we have to presume that all statutory notices were given. It cannot make that determination without doing a full construction of the statute. And as to any type of rendering anything superfluous, nugatory, and meaningless, it doesn't. As we've discussed before, Your Honors, that it expands 31163, 31165, and 107090 provide an ability for different people to get notice. 107.090.3b and 4 require mandatory notice for junior lien holders of record like the bank. When you get to 31163 and 31165, for those persons of interest who request notice, the formal request for notice, that can be somebody who has an interest in the property but is not a lien holder. Mm-hmm. Then you have the holders of a recorded security interest who have notified the association. This was a MERS deed to begin with, MERS deed of trust. MERS holds it and transfers deeds of trust among all sorts of people before they finally put it in somebody's name. If that person who is the holder of a recorded security interest, but not the holder of record, wants to know what's going on with their deed of trust, they can notify the association. It's for those shadow people who for whatever reason choose not to comply with Nevada recording statutes. So there's no surplusage here. There may be some overlap, but it's not surplusage. It's not meaningless.
Was, at the time this sale took place by the HOA and Star Golden bought, bid in, who was up record as the beneficiary of this deed of trust?
According to the record, it would be Bank of New York Mellon. There was an assignment in 2011 to Bank of New York Mellon from MERS, which leads me then.
So wouldn't the Bank of New York Mellon be entitled to notice that under 107090?
Absolutely.
Okay.
And that leads into the evidence that they claim that the bank claims it gave. The letter says it's from Bannon, Bank of America, who says that it's acting on behalf of MERS and is the beneficiary. And I don't know where it got that. There's nothing in the record that supports that. But if Banner wanted notice directly, that's where it would have come from letting somebody know. If they were a shadow person as a servicer or a person with interest, they can file a request for notice, but they're not the beneficiary of record. You only have to send to the people known to you, and that would be the beneficiary of record that's on notice. So it leads into the next argument. But before I finish, this court should take the opportunity to once again construe the statutes as it did in SFR with full incorporation of 107090. The Ninth Circuit will be bound by that construction regardless of Born Valley. And when it comes to Nevada law, it can't be said more strongly. This court leads. The federal courts follow. This court should affirm summary judgment for three reasons. First, their inquiry letter isn't a tender. The discharge is a lien. Their constitutionality argument fails for multiple reasons. And the district court didn't abuse its discretion in not granting 56F relief. As to the tender and the evidence that they purport to, let's be clear, this was not a tender. A tender requires an unconditional payment of money, and this court should hold the same. At best, this is an inquiry letter. In the cases where you have a contract and tender, the case they rely on, there's an actual sum, a specific sum due. Here at the time of this sale, or this letter, Emerald hadn't come out with its opinion. So the only thing that was out there about what could be collected would include collection costs, et cetera. And the letter says, well, we'll pay 9 months, but it wasn't unconditional. It stated, if you provide us adequate proof, without defining what adequate would mean. So I get to decide whether you've provided me enough proof of what to pay. Second, this will discharge every Banner's obligations to the HOA with no definition of time.
Was there a written response to their, you're referring to it as an inquiry letter, was there a response to that inquiry letter?
That's a great question, Your Honor. There's nothing in the record. But let's go over the timeline for this.
So we have this inquiry. You're indicating there's no response. Why was it not in the interest of the parties for the district court to allow some discovery as to this issue to ferret it out?
Well, Your Honor, and this court may decide to send it back for that inquiry, but let's take a look. I think the district court was correct in saying there was no issue of material fact, because, for a couple reasons, by their own evidence, they sent, if we accepted all as true, the letter was sent by mail on May 24th, 2012. That's a Thursday before Memorial Day weekend. On May 31st, a mere 4 business days later, there's a notation in there that they want to close the file. 4 business days later. Even this court allows 3 days for mailing.
It was they want to close the file. Who's they? Who are you referring to?
Miles Bauer, the agent for the bank. On June 5th, so on May 31st, there's a note about that. On June 5th, they prepare their final bill, and they close the file.
When was the
sale? 10 days after they send them in.
What was the sale date of the property?
It was 2 years later. And this letter, if it was an actual tender letter, an unconditional offer to pay, which I don't believe it was, under the Restatement Third of Mortgages, Section 6.4G, if the person is not the person with primary responsibility for the debt, and in this case that would be the homeowner with primary responsibility for the debt to the association, wants to satisfy the lien, they must send the funds, and if rejected, must keep the offer open. Again, the timeline shows you there was no intent to keep this offer open. There was no intent to show that we are ready, willing, and always able to pay.
A concern I have, being very blunt about it, is because of the lack of record as to this issue when you're presenting this argument, that wasn't before the court. And yes, I can accept it as true now, but the problem is the district court was not in a position to accept what you're offering as true at the time. So I'm curious as to no issues of fact being in dispute in order to grant a summary judgment.
Your Honor, and if this court determines that there should be some dispute,
what is your strongest position as to why the summary judgment should be granted?
I believe that summary judgment on this issue should be granted because the evidence that the bank has in its possession showed that it may have sent a letter. To be clear, nothing in that, in the, you look at the lines on their file, nothing says it was sent. All it says is that I'm sending an email regarding initial letters. So it doesn't even say that they were sent. Their own evidence doesn't support it. And this was the time for them to show from their files what they did. There's no envelope. There's no PDF of this letter. There's nothing to show that they actually sent it. But even assuming that it was true that it was sent, they closed their file 10 days later.
Well, Ms. Garanche, I'm concerned about the delay. That bothers me, you know, with the delay between the time this letter went out and the date of the sale. Because apparently there was never any effort to ever file suit and get a TRO against the sale or anything. It just was allowed to go forward.
Yes, it appears, according to their own evidence, they provided nothing to show they did anything after they closed the file on this case. Nothing from Bank of America, nothing from Bank of New York Mellon.
Can I ask you this? In the interest of time, another issue I'm concerned about is Shadowwood wasn't out when Judge Smith decided this case. What impact does Shadowwood have on looking at what Judge Smith did now? What's your position on that?
I think that Shadowwood provides for this court and for Judge Smith that they have to look at each case individually, that there should be no bright line rule that I sent some letter and I win, because that appears to be the bank's position. But if there has to be a weighing of equities and looking at it based on the evidence before the court at that time, which was we may have sent a letter, and I can't even if I accept it as true, there doesn't appear to be any evidence that they did anything else, that there may be no question of fact. If you believe there is, then send it back to develop the record. And I can certainly understand that and allow them to balance under Shadowwood. If this was considered a tender, and again, I don't believe it was, but if this was considered a tender, or this letter was sent in the fairness, then it needs to be balanced against the ability or the person to know whether or not this all happened, the purchaser. Even Shadowwood quoted Murray DeBernardi saying that a BFP of legal title is not affected by any latent equity founded either on a trust, encumbrance, or otherwise, of which he has no notice. And I believe, and we briefed, it was briefed in here that you have to put somebody on notice. If you're going to change your lien position, it's something affecting real property. This letter is something affecting real property that they claim discharged their debt. That has to be recorded. People have to be able to understand recording stat, what's on record. They have to be able to rely on it. That's what real property law relies on, is the recording statutes. That's on page 1115, by the way, when it talks about inquiry notice. And then at the end of Shadowwood, it states, where the complaining party has access to all the facts that surround and question the question transaction, equity should normally not interfere, especially where the rights of third parties are prejudiced. If you believe a record needs to be developed on the basis of tender, I certainly can understand that. But this inquiry letter, I understand that and would send it back.
But let me ask you one other question. To my recollection, the court has talked about the requirements of a tender in this type of situation here, what you have to show. And it may have been a case, I can't remember the case, but it might have been an order and all like that. Have both sides looked at our case law on that, where we discussed that tender issue, you know, like that? Or again, it may not be an opinion. I'm trying to remember the case right now, but I know we did discuss it.
I believe it is an order And I'm reluctant to discuss it because I believe it's on a petition for en banc reconsideration.
Was it an order after we allowed orders to be, you know, was it after January 1 of 2015?
No.
Okay, then it's not
unless I'm thinking of somebody. No, it was a relatively recent order.
Okay.
Okay,
why?
Well, it was post-Shadowwood.
Post-Shadowwood.
But even the case, like I said, the cases where you discuss tender, even prior cases where you discuss tender, not under these circumstances, but tender in general, don't talk about the rights of third parties. Finally, the 56F affidavit was deficient. You don't get to go into looking for things in your own files. And if you look at the actual affidavit on page 100 of the record, all of these specifics that Mr. Stern discussed, none of those are in this affidavit. There were no specifics in this affidavit. There were generalities in a fishing expedition. But to the extent that you believe that there should be more of a record in this case, then remand on the factual issues. But do not remand on the issue of constitutionality. Do not even take that up here. They waived it. They admit that they waived constitutionality, the facial constitutionality below. They brought it up in a motion for reconsideration. District court didn't have to entertain it, and neither does this court.
Warren Valley, if they accept your cert petition, we might have some guidance one way or the other from the U.S. Supreme Court.
And allow me to say again, Your Honor, that the U.S. Supreme Court will take guidance from this court on the construction of the statute. And I truly believe that this court should take the opportunity to present what this statute actually says. The federal courts are bound by that. This court knows it's not bound by Bourne Valley. Rather than...
I hope you're right on you, but we had a recent experience where they didn't on our interpretation of the statute.
Ms. Gilbert, before you sit down, I'm looking at the order that was entered by the court, and it says, defendant has neither shown nor alleged either that the HLA failed to comply with NRS 116 or that the sale was commercially unreasonable, and therefore defendant has not established genuine issue of material fact to avoid summary judgment. Counsel's representation was he was attempting to establish commercial unreasonableness. However, since he was not allowed to have any discovery, he could not do so. What is your response to that?
My response to that, Your Honor, is if you look at page 100 and 101 of the record for the affidavit for 56F relief, it says it's a fishing expedition. We want to see whether it was properly, whether there was provided notice to BNY Mellon, they admitted that, and whether tender is excused, got that, whether it was commercially sale, unreasonable. They don't give any reasons why. If you have your specifics, you can't simply say, hey, I want to find out if they did this right. I have to have a good faith belief that there is something that I'm going to find, not a fishing expedition. And let's be clear, this sale took place over 2 months after counsel stood before this court and argued SFRB U.S. Bank. They know why the price was what it was. Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Ms. Gilbert. Mr. Stern, I'm going to give you the full 4 minutes, if you'll put the clock at 4 minutes. Thank you. Or you rebuttal.
Thank you. So, starting with the state law issues first. With respect to tender, we dispute that there was any conditions in the letter. The letter basically said we will pay, or the bank will pay 9 months, whatever that amount may be, subject to proof of that. That's no different than any ordinary person asking a creditor to show them a bill. That's not a condition. You have the right to ask your credit card company to show you a bill so you know how much you owe before you pay. The letter wasn't saying anything more than that. That's not a condition.
But the bank never actually tendered any funds to the HOA?
We never delivered funds, Justice Gibbons. We believe that the letter itself is a sufficient tender, meaning that it has the legal effect of discharging the lien because there was no response from the association. Now, we understand that that may be a controverted point that, as a matter of just practice, should be resolved in the district court first, and the district court did not reach that issue.
Okay.
I cannot explain why. So when we believe there should be a remand, that's one of the issues for sure that should be addressed on remand. Our 56F affidavit found in page 101 of the record says, and I'm quoting from line 3, one of the things we want to look at is whether the HOA sale was commercially unreasonable in violation of NRS 116.1113. And then in paragraph 4, we explain the types of discovery we want to take, including a deposition from the agency, the collection agency, and perhaps an expert to opine on the fair market value. Was that sufficient detail for the district court? We don't know because the order is silent. It doesn't explain, doesn't even actually say that it denies 56F relief, as if it wasn't even there. And so, again, as a matter of appellate versus trial practice, this is something that should have been developed more fully in the district court. And we believe when it does get developed in the district court, we're going to show that the sale was, in fact, commercially unreasonable.
But Ms. Gilbert says that we shouldn't consider the constitutional issues because they were only raised in your motion for rehearing before the district court.
And I anticipated that, Justice Gibbons, and that's why I pointed out that the district court granted reconsideration and then reaffirmed its decision. So I think this is an area where the district court has some discretion that in this case it chose to exercise in favor of considering the argument and therefore it wasn't waived as a matter of appellate. That's our position on that.
Okay.
With respect to the constitutionality, since we're there, we disagree that SFR Investments held that 107.090 is incorporated. There's quite a bit of language in SFR regarding due process and notice, but I remind the court that in that case, we were before you on a 12b-5 motion where you were considering all of the allegations made in the complaint as true as is required under 12b-5, and one of those was that all requirements of law were followed. And so the court basically said at this stage, I think it was described as broken, meaning we're not really sure where this due process challenge is going, but on the facts as alleged in the complaint, applying the rule 12b-5 standard, we're going to assume their truth and remanded on that basis. The court did not remand with instruction to the district court that the statute is constitutional. To the contrary, the SFR Investments decision leaves the due process challenge to be resolved after factual inquiry. The other point that I think is important to make is that in that case, we never challenged the statute facially. That's something that came later. And the Ninth Circuit in Bourne Valley was definitely aware of that. And so the suggestion that the Ninth Circuit has overstepped its bound, it's simply not the case. The SFR said some things about due process, but it never resulted in it. I'll remind the court again that there are various other orders where you have remanded without having resolved that issue, the facial challenge. Thank you.
Thank you.
Good. Thanks, both Mr. Stern and Ms. Gilbert, for your excellent briefs and an argument in this matter. Hopefully no court will ever have to face the recession that we had to face from 2008 through today with all the foreclosures, and we'll never have these situations again. This case is standing, but thank you very much, everybody. Have a good weekend.